You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Sixteen on a Tuesday. Mike Musselman joins me from the great state of Texas. Gunner, what is up? How are you?
What's going on?
Nothing. We're just talking about Warren Jeffers? Is that his name?
Warren Jeffs. Warren Speed Jeffs. He was the polygamist that was caught. He had like 65 wives, and some of his wives were like 12 years old.
So tell us about Warren Jeffs. How does he, would it surprise us? Does it tell you anything about the women that he was involved with? Anything about them? Would it surprise us the diversity of his wives?
He's just a sick, perverted, you know, pedophile that was using a church and his prophecies of God telling him that to take these women at age of 12 and marry them and have children.
And so were they all
young? God told me to do it.
Yeah, no kidding. Were they all young women?
Most of his wives were under the age of 17. So yeah, they were all children.
Wow. And so he's doing this in Utah?
Arizona.
Let me guess, in some version of the vicinity of the Amboy Crater, like an Arizona version of the Amboy Crater, yes?
Kind of. I mean, in a very remote place, right on the Utah-Arizona border.
Right.
The LDS church kicked they call them the FLDS, which is like, I think they're called fundamentalists. Latter-day Saints, the ones that still believe in polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
And they kicked him out of Utah, so they built a compound in basically a small city, Stone Creek, I think it was, or something like that, in Arizona. And then when the law started coming down on Jeffs for the stuff that he was doing, the crimes that he committed, he went on the run. And he became one of the FBI's top 10 most wanted people.
Yeah. How does, I would imagine a guy like that who doesn't have an electronic signature, and living in the Arizona version of the Amboy Crater, unless somebody identifies you, and you probably have another identity, then it's not going to be easy to identify somebody that lives like that. So,
I know. You know, he had his church members, and he had thousands of them. They make them ran up their credit cards, take, another mortgage out on their home, and then give them all the money to the church.
So were these people online, or were they local people, or what? Both?
What do you mean, local?
Well, when you say church members, did he have an organized...
Oh, yeah. He had a huge, huge following of people that believed that he was the prophet of God.
In Arizona? Or
in Arizona, yeah.
And Utah?
And Utah.
Wow.
And somewhere in South Dakota, here in Texas, he had all these camps, these other retreats that he could, hide out at. And then hide the underage women from, the eyes of the law.
What do you make of all that? I mean, to me, there's people want to believe in stuff, and you look at some of the things that they believe in, and it's just like, come on, are you serious? And I don't know.
Well, the brainwashing starts when they're born. So they're born into the church. So children, he's looked upon as, he's the face of the church. And he's telling the only way is to salvation is, you know, to do this. That if you don't do this, then you don't go to heaven. So these young women are, you know, 10 and 11 years old. All they've ever known is they don't, there's no contact from the outside world. They don't even know that there's, you know, that there's a place called America.
What? Where does he find people like this?
They're born into the church.
In Arizona?
So they're all close.
In the United States?
Yeah. Crazy, man.
Yeah, it is crazy. Well, just remember the whole Jonestown thing, and, you know, he left and went to Guyana, and all those people went with him?
Oh, yeah.
And then they all committed suicide? It's like, how does some crazy bit of nonsense like that happen?
Well, because he promises them salvation.
I know, but at some point.
Yeah, how do you, well, and see, you're trying to, again, you're trying to, we're trying to rationalize it through our eyes. Yeah.
I was going to say, there's nobody like you or me in that group, I can tell that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the whole idea of polygamy, you know, is appealing, you know, until you start thinking about having two wives. I mean, one is a full day's work, right? What is two?
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
What is three?
Someone in their right mind that thinks that having
more than one wife?
Well, and it's different, though. So you got women that, you know, in their church, their beliefs are that women are second to men. You know, women are subservient. So, again, I mean, very closely to the, you know, the Muslims.
But I haven't seen too many Muslim cults like what we're talking about. Right? They tend...
I can't remember.
They probably keep the lid on those stores.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, Warren Jeffs had hundreds of millions of dollars.
What?
And again, his church, man. His followers.
God almighty, man. That's crazy when you think about that. Hey, I want to talk to you. You teased, I want to change the subject. You, last night we were texting and you said you went to Iwo Jima in 1986 as part of an exercise. I want to hear about that. So you guys do a landing and you spend, how many days are you on the island?
Like 3 days, 4 days.
So describe for those of us who've never been, what's it like? You said there was gear all over the place still.
Well, in 1986, we were told that we were the first large contingent of Marines that had been on the island since literally like the early 50s. So it was right after the war. And then after that, we turned the island over to the Japanese.
Right.
And so the one airfield that we were at, which was, I can't remember which airfield it was, over two, it was still active. I mean, it had hangars, it had a control tower, it had Japanese F-4 Phantom jet there that were assigned there, and they do a rotation. And then on the other side of the island, on the lower part of Mount Sarabachi, there was a Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard Lorraine station, when they used to use that for navigation, and they'd have to man that, and there was a very small contingent of U.S. Coast Guard guys living on the island.
Right.
So we landed on the island. We flew into the island. They landed us, dropped us off the airport. And then our role really was, we were going to do a non-combat kind of, you know, evacuation, kind of simulate an embassy. And then the BLP was going to come ashore and do their thing. And I was playing the role of, like an embassy guard. But yeah, it was just the whole setup. So the exercise was going to take place like within 3 days. We had 3 days to get ready to be the role players. And then, so the first day we landed, we were living in our shelter house just on the other side of the airstrip. And then the Japanese guys and some of the Coast Guard guys picked us up in vans and trucks and drove us and gave us a tour of the whole island.
Tell me about, you said there was gear laying around. So you're driving around the island.
Oh, everywhere.
What is it? So tell me about it.
I mean, there were tank hulks, there were vehicle bodies. Just very, you know, just over time destroyed. There were landing craft that was still on the beach, sunk, you know, off the shore.
Right.
You could see the outlines of the small, LST ships that were coming ashore that were still wrecked out there in the water.
Right.
There were still, you know, bombers, American bombers, their skeletons of their aircraft that were still up, laying all over the place.
Wow. I didn't realize that. What? What do you?
So when Rob said, I was kind of surprised when Rob said that he grabbed some of that stuff, because when we came back in 93, I think it was, even then, we weren't allowed to, you can't even touch that stuff. It was still, because it was considered like a sacred place. It was a memorial.
Yeah, it's a Japanese burial ground. Is how the Japanese.
Yeah, we couldn't even pick up a brass casing that was on the ground.
Yeah.
And then the only place.
And Montana Man said that, you know, he took, a few brass casings, and which I would imagine are everywhere still. And then a piece of a radio or something like that, or a piece of.
Yeah, we couldn't touch anything.
Yeah, and then he put it in a jar and filled a jar full of black sand and gave it to his first sergeant later. I was surprised to hear that, too. I was not, for whatever reason, I was surprised that there's still that much stuff laying around. I'm a huge fan of that battle because I've read about it a bunch. And actually, you know, it goes back to Zinni and that PME he had. He said, you know, in your reading, pick one battle and learn everything about it. Learn how they did medical, learn how they did administration, learn how they did logistics, learn how they did comm. And it will change the way you look at every other battle. But pick one and read everything you can about it. And then it'll further your efforts, your education in other areas and other battles. And so I thought, and I've done that with Iwo Jima, and probably a little bit fascinated that it's not occupied except by the Japanese and that air facility these days, and it's still remarkably the same as it was back then. And I'm incredibly jealous, you know, of people that have got to go. And I would love to go on a tour of it, you know, and they do take civilian tours there sometimes for very short periods of time. Did they take you into any caves? I would imagine that they did not.
Yeah, we went into went into several caves. We went into small caves. Very large caves. We were on one cave that was like on, I think the south side of Mount Suribachi. It was facing the landing beaches.
Right.
It had a gun emplacement, that was hidden in the side of the mountain. And, we walked through that. And there was, you walk in and it wasn't pristine.
Right.
I mean, gear was laying around and stuff, but there were still like, carved out shelving and carved out little nooks where there was Japanese helmets, rifles, bayonets, ammunition, grenades, machine gun tripods, remnants of rusted up machine gun parts, gas masks. You could tell they were still, you know, by just the shape of them. Like I said, there was just a ton of stuff, but there was still a lot of marked off unexploded ordnance that someone, you know. But, you know, and then we went to the top of Mount Suribachi. There was a big plaque up there, you know, Nimitz, the uncommon valor was a common virtue type of thing. And that was up there. But the division cemeteries were still there when I was there. And there was one that was still, I think they were either at that point, exhuming the bodies and moving them. And I don't know if they moved them to Hawaii or where they moved them. But there was still one of the, I think it was either the 5th or, I can't remember, 5th Marine Division Cemetery, had the archway over the top. It had the division symbol above it. Yeah, it had the division symbol above it, and it had all the crosses in it. And pretty, like I said, it was just a very somber tour where we went everywhere. We went to the cliffs on the other side of the island where the Japanese were, you know, basically jumped and committed ritual suicide into the water. We visited the Japanese ceremony or a cemetery, and that was still very recently being, people coming and leaving things behind. There were bottles of sake, pitchers, you know, all sorts of stuff that were laying on the graves of the Japanese soldiers that died there from families and stuff.
Of the 20,000, approximately 20,000 Japanese soldiers who died and you know, their bodies were never recovered, and they're someplace decomposed in that island. I was reading about, have you ever read Tony Stein, who built his own machine gun, called him the Stinger, with a 30 caliber Browning machine gun, but he got it out of a Navy fighter, and he nicknamed it the Stinger, and he was some kind of machinist in his civilian life, and so after the Vella Lavella and Bougainville campaigns, they were, I don't know where the hell he was. But he winds up with Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 28th Marines on Iwo Jima. And before they go to Iwo Jima, he builds like three of these things, 30 caliber, and he puts the stock of, I want to say, an M1 on it. And he builds his own machine gun. And so I saw on the History Channel or something, they built one. And it caught, you know, I'm like, all of a sudden I see Tony Stein Stinger. And I'm like, whoa. And he sounds like, I mean, reading about him, he reminded me of you, Mike, because he's mechanically inclined, and he decides he's going to build these things. And he's he receives the Medal of Honor for his gallantry on Iwo Jima. And he receives it posthumously. And I was just looking. It says he was buried in 1948. I can't remember. Yeah. He was initially buried in the 5th Division ceremony on Cemetery on Iwo Jima. Following the war, his remains were returned to the U.S. for reinterment in Dayton, Ohio. Stein's, Dayton's only World War II recipient of the Medal of Honor, was buried with full military honors on December 17th, 1948, at Calvary Cemetery. The, if you ever get a chance to watch, it might be How Things Work or something like that, or it might have been a gun show, but this thing was awesome. 30 caliber, you know, shoulder fired weapon. With a carrying handle on the barrel. And, and then, he went, his Medal of Honor says that he went, let's see, in action against the Japanese forces on Iwo Jima, February 19th, the first man of his unit to be on station after hitting the beach in the initial assault. Corporal Stein, armed with a personally improvised aircraft type weapon, provided rapid covering fire as the remainder of his platoon attempted to move into position. When his comrades were stalled by a concentrated machine gun and mortar barrage, he gallantly stood upright, exposed himself to the enemy's view, thereby drawing the hostile fire to his own person, enabling him to observe the location of the furiously blazing hostile guns. Determined to neutralize the fire of his strategically placed weapons, he boldly charged the enemy pillboxes one by one and succeeded in killing 20 of the enemy during a furious single-handed assault. Cool and courageous under the merciless hail of exploding shells and bullets, which fell on all sides, he continued to deliver the fire from his skillfully improvised weapon at a tremendous rate of speed, which rapidly exhausted his ammunition. Undaunted, he removed his helmet and shoes to expedite his movement and ran back to the beach for additional ammunition, making a total of 8 trips under intense fire and carrying or assisting a wounded man back each time. Despite the unrelenting savagery and confusion of the battle, he rendered prompt assistance to his platoon whenever the unit was in position, directing the fire of a half-track against a stubborn pillbox until he had effected the ultimate destruction of the Japanese fortification. Later in the day, although his weapon was twice shot from his hands, he personally covered the withdrawal of his platoon to the company position. Stout-hearted and indomitable, Corporal Stein, by his aggressive nature, sound judgment, unwavering devotion to duty, faced with terrific odds. Wow. Wow. 8 times, yeah. Mike, back to the beach, barefoot.
Right.
How
well, it's not a, you know, is it one thing that really kind of, there's a couple things that shocked me about Iwo Jima. One, how small it was. You know, so from the beach, from the beach to the front line, you're talking about 100 yards or so. So it's not like it was a journey. You know, the difficulty would have been you're under fire. You know, but it wasn't very, distance-wise, wasn't far at all. The second thing that really kind of shocked me was the smell of the sulfur, because it's a volcanic island.
Right.
And there's still steam coming out on the other side of the beach. It's kind of, you know, built like a pork chop.
Right.
And then where Sarabachi was, on the other side of that, there were the sulfur pits that, you know, were still, I mean, hell, in 1986, there was still steam coming out of the ground from vented hot springs. And, you know, just that overwhelming stench of sulfur that was in the air was, oh, it was horrible. It was wretched. And then the other thing was the actual black sand beach, you know, and we stood at the water line and started walking up, because they're kind of a steep beach. And we started walking up, walking in that black sand beach. Cause it's not like sand. It's like a very small pebbles.
Right.
And your feet sink. It's hard for every step you're taking. You're sinking. You're falling back. You really, it takes a lot out of you. And like I said, I had no gear on. And by the time I got to the top of the beach from the waterline, I was set. You know, it was a good, good workout in your legs. You could feel it.
Right.
Coupled that with, being under fire and the weight, it would have been horrible. And then, you know, the shells landing on the beach. Oh, I could just imagine.
8 times though. And taking somebody back, 8 times with you. So, and in this program, I can't remember the unit at Camp Lejeune, but they do a Tony Stein, fitness test. And it's you gotta go 8 lengths, and they measured the distance between where the platoon was, and the beach. And so I can't remember how long that is, how many hundred meters it is. And
right.
you gotta carry somebody every time, and then you gotta bring ammunition back. And they do that as a PT event. So he's with 28 Marines, right? They put the flag up on Iwo Jima. Let's see.
Yeah, and you know what was cool too is on the top of Mount Sarabachi, and it was just behind the big white memorial for the battle that Nimitz had in. There was a black marble post. Came out of the ground probably 6 inches, and on the top of there was a square post that went in to mark, and then on top of that had a circle with an X through it, and that's exactly what they did. Was that was marked the actual hole that the flag was raised on.
Wow.
And so you're standing there and you're looking down, and that was the kind of like that wow feeling where you're standing there and you're just picturing, you know, when all of the ships would have been out there and they started sounding their horns and sirens and the flag went up.
Right.
And you could see that flag from everywhere in the island.
Right.
You know, like I said, it wasn't a big island at all. It was just remarkably small.
I mean, and when you think about that, ultimately there's 60,000 combatants on that island in that small, you know, what it's called, hell in a very small place. I mean, that's what I think they called Dien Bien Phu too. But Iwo Jima, essentially no prisoners taken by either side, and the Japanese below the ground and the Marines above the ground. It's one of the most unique battles in the history of warfare like that in terms of its violence.
The Japanese had years to build the defensive positions for that.
Right. I've had so many different guys that I've spoken to that fought there said, yeah, I don't, you know, that Japanese commanding general, he's the smartest guy that they produced during the war because, you know, he did not let them sacrifice themselves needlessly. You know, his whole thing of you have to kill or wound 10 Americans before you're allowed to die, was one of his standing orders. The way all their positions were mutually supporting, it was pretty amazing. Stein is wounded during the fight for Suribachi, and he's evacuated to a hospital ship, which normally meant you were going home. The regiment advanced up the west side of the island, where they encounter something I talked about an hour ago, which is Hill 362 Alpha, which was this gigantic hill on the western side, but it had been honeycombed with tunnels and bunkers. And then it's surrounded on about 180 degrees by the central plateau, and that gave, from that central plateau, they could isolate Hill 362. Anyway, 28th Marines takes a lot of casualties, and he hears about it. He leaves the hospital ship and goes back to his company. On March 1st, he's killed by a sniper leading a 19-man patrol to reconnoiter a machine gun emplacement, which had the company pinned down. So, yeah, that whole thing, where do we get such guys? So that guy making his own weapon, right, while they're on Guam or back in Hawaii, and, you know, gets it shot out of his hands three times, gets wounded, medevac to a ship, and then comes off the ship and winds up being killed. Pretty,
and, you know, and then there was
stories.
A lot of controversy of why they took Iwo Jima. You know, people asked, well, what was the significance of it? And, you know, when you look at the numbers of U.S. airmen that were saved, I mean, it's in the thousands of people that owed their life, bomber pilots, B-29 guys, B-24 guys, that were flying missions that came back and would have either A, ditched in the sea or crash landed, you know, and ultimately would have lost their lives. It was that halfway point from Guam.
I believe it's close to 1-to-1, Mike, in terms of for every life that was lost.
For every life that was lost, one was saved.
And so I think, I'll Google it here.
But even at the end, towards the end of the battle was still raging when crippled B-29s were landing at the airfield.
That's hilarious when you hear those stories. You know, they're up there just getting it on, right? And you know, there was, armored bulldozers and things like that working on the airfield, and then, a B-29 is going to ditch in the ocean, and even though the airfield's not finished, they said, hey, we got no choice. And these things are gigantic, right?
Yeah, and it's 11 or 12 guys that are lost immediately when that one thing goes down. Not one guy. It's not a one-for-one. You know, when you shoot down a bomber, you're talking about several lives that are going to go.
I'm looking for
10 bombers is over 100 men.
I think when you the strategy of there's other islands, I want to say like Saipan and some other ones that you look at and say, you know, there wasn't really anything there other than a Japanese garrison. We could have bypassed them and not fought that fight. And focused on their,
starved them out,
and there was nothing they could do except rot there. But Iwo Jima, not one of them. Iwo Jima with its airfields and its distance, between, Guam and Tinian is where we were flying out of was the place. And so, But no, I'm extremely jealous of both you guys for having been there. And then you went back again, right? You went twice?
Yeah, I went back again.
What year did you go the second time? And had it changed much from the first time?
Oh yeah, it was completely different. The Coast Guard place was gone. The cemeteries were gone. Most of the caves were closed off.
How did they close them? Did they close them with dirt? Did they close them with something else?
No, they had a chicken wire.
Okay.
They put chicken wire over the entrances.
And that had been
the bigger ones.
Had they, Mike, the first time you went, had they been turned over to the Japanese yet? Because I think Reagan
did. Yeah, it was
completely,
they owned it.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, it was their island.
All right.
But they were great hosts. I mean, they were great guys, the Japanese, you know, I forget what they called, Japanese Defense Force?
Yeah, Japanese Self-Defense Force, JDF.
So they were great hosts. I mean, when we landed, as we were getting set up, they came in with this big, huge forklift and on it was this pallet. It was, and I tried to describe it. It's a cooler that fits on a pallet. You know, it's the size of it fits exactly on a pallet, but it's about 4 feet high and it's got a big zipper top. So it's a big foam padded, looks like a big, it's like a collapsible cooler, you know, and it was lined, and about halfway it was filled with ice and beer. There was more beer in that thing than there were Marines. I mean, and for us to drink all that beer, all of us would have been, and it was probably close to maybe 80 guys that were, you know, spent that time there.
What kind of beer?
You could drink a case of beer. Oh, everything from, I mean, I have a picture, and I was looking for it last night. I'll find it. But it's me holding up, and I have a patch. I bought it from the Coast Guard that says Iwo Jima, the United States Coast Guard, Lorraine Station, and in the middle is the flag raising. It was their unit patch, and I still got it. And
you know, if you look on the internet, there are.
I was drinking Michelob.
Michelob, holy shit!
Yeah,
with the foil
on it, you know, the gold foil,
the gold Michelob. Back in the day, no, but there were guys that were stationed on Iwo Jima. I mean, you can imagine there's just nothing there, and so what they did was they exercised, right, and they went exploring, and this is when the United States owned it, and there was no Japanese presence there. And you'll see guys who were there, served there in the Air Force, in the Coast Guard, they would put up, they'll put up websites with their pictures of when they were on active duty. And, you know, some of it's very cool.
Yeah.
Email, listening to Gunner talk and hearing Max jealousy, I'm just curious, what do you think is the coolest historical thing that either one of you has ever seen? Oh, that's a good question, Mike. The coolest historical thing.
Oh, that's easy.
Okay, what is it?
I saw the wall come down. I was in England when, I was in England. I got there 88 and I left there 91. And so we got word that, you know, things were going on in East Germany. So we took some time off and flew over across the channel, got to West Berlin, and then we witnessed, I think we missed it, we missed the actual, like, when they started tearing the wall down by just a couple of days, but we were there when that whole party
was going on.
Oh yeah, man, we were drinking with East German border guards for days, never understanding a word they said.
That was crazy. Because we grew up with, you know, the Soviet Union and the Red Menace and all that, and it was falling apart. And, to watch those scenes on TV, those walls and Germans on top of them, you know, cutting them and knocking them over, and it was crazy.
Yeah. And I'll never forget, a buddy of mine, we were talking about something, and there was a big chunk of the wall that had rebar sticking out of it, and it had, all the graffiti that was still on it from the West German side.
Right.
And half of a sign, a Platz, you know, like Mara Platz or whatever, you know, everything's a Platz, like a plaza in Germany.
Right.
And on this brick, the big thing, a sign was bolted into half of it was the word Platz. So the other part was ripped off. So he had said, like, hey, let's take this with us. You know, this is going to be something, you know, one day that we're going to look back and go, oh, we got a piece of the wall. And we were all like, shut up. You know, like, whatever. Like, they're really going to sell pieces of the wall. Come on. Really? And we left, and we just, you know, it's like, now you look back and like, you son of a bitch.
I've seen some cool stuff in my life, but I will tell you that when I think of that, at the National Museum of the Marine Corps, the first time I went, you went into the ship and then you went on this land in a simulated briefing room, just a compartment on a ship, and they brief you about the invasion of Iwo Jima, and then you get into this, I've been told that they had to redo it because the fire marshal said you can't do it like this. But it was a mock-up of a landing craft with screens 360 degrees, and they kind of they simulate going.
Oh, it was a tractor. It wasn't a landing craft. It was an early amphibious tractor.
Yeah, but it's a Higgins boat because the front ramp goes down.
Oh, was it?
I think I will tell you this. It's the video is of a tractor, but the mock-up you're in is a Higgins boat, so it's kind of a little bit of a hybrid. And then the ramp goes down, and in front of you is one of the two flags that went up on Mount Suribachi. And I, for whatever reason, that still to me is to think that, you know, you look at that picture and the symbolism in the Marine Corps, and then all of a sudden you're looking at the flag. You know, it's very cool. Very cool little piece of history that is in they used to display either flag, now they display both.
Right.
Which is cool. So yeah, very, very Gettysburg, very cool history too. But
yeah, the other place that I had a really good time was I was in France in the 200-year anniversary of the French Revolution.
Wow.
And I was in Paris listening to Duran Duran play underneath the Eiffel Tower.
Do you have a favorite place in Europe? Did you get how many different countries did you see most of Europe while you were over there?
Yeah, I was I went to France, Germany, Belgium, all the lowlands, you know, Netherlands, right. Denmark.
Right.
Went to Ireland, Scotland, Wales.
Favorite country?
Spain, Portugal, Italy, Switzerland, Austria. Went into Russia one time. Favorite country?
Yeah, what is your favorite?
Probably Spain.
Spain?
Yeah.
Spain looks beautiful. The architecture is absolutely, Barcelona, the architecture there is absolutely beautiful. Why Spain, Mike?
Because it was just, everything there was just fantastic, man. It was just beautiful. Yeah, the people were great. The food was fantastic. The scenery was remarkable.
Right.
It was just a really good time.
Were you, where were you? Were you on the Atlantic side or the Mediterranean side?
Both sides. I went to Gibraltar.
Oh.
I had the opportunity, like I said, I took advantage of it on everywhere.
No kidding. So you were on Barrack Studio over there for, was that 2 years or three?
It was supposed to be for 4 years.
Whoa.
But when I got there, I'm trying to think what year I left right when I left at 3 years, and the reason they'd taken all the special weapons out of the country.
Right.
We kind of lost our job. There was no reason for us to stay there for another year.
Wow. Wow. All right. Interesting. Interesting. No, I'm jealous of the Iwo Jima thing. And I love listening to these, like, first, these, you know, as the audio of broadcast from Iwo Jima, the way we did it back then. You didn't have people filing their own reports. You know, you had the official, you know, reports that were put out by the Marine Corps, and the correspondents, you know, to hear them talk as they're on the island and stuff like that, and in the midst of all that craziness, pretty crazy. So, anyway, what else you got going on today?
Well, that's about it, man. I mean, not much. It's raining. The weather is pretty crappy today.
Yeah, it was 31 degrees in 29 Palms this morning. It was 38 at Pendleton. Cold in California. Winter finally arrived.
Yeah.
We don't see those numbers, but you guys were up in the 70s already this morning, so you're all right.
And then this week it's supposed to drop back down again, you know, to the 50s, so, and then it'll get warm again, so.
It was
going back and forth.
I want to say it was below zero up in Montana this morning.
Really?
Yeah, Montana man up all night with a new calf that was born and wouldn't eat or whatever they do.
Yeah, you know what that's called? Veal.
That's not the way he looks at it. 12 degrees, wow. 12 degrees below zero in Big Timber, Montana.
Yeah, I would have said that's Veal.
He's up. He was sending pictures, you know, feeding a baby cow with a bottle at 2 in the morning. Nice. You want to be a farmer? You want to be a rancher? There you go. There you go. It's not just about taking your macho picture and your cowboy hat. Got to get up and feed the cow with a bottle.
Right.
Anyway. All right, man. Thanks for doing this today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
All right.
We'll talk to you later. Have a good day.
All right. Have a good day. We'll talk to you on Thursday. That is the Gunner.
All right.
The one and only Michael Musselman here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio. And coincidentally. Peleliu. Not Saipan. Ohio man was paying attention. My swag was Saipan was not necessary. Fact of the matter, Peleliu was the one. Or Peleliu, as some would pronounce it. My thanks to Chris Woodbridge for coming on. And I would recommend, very seriously, if you like reading and you like period pieces, those the digital archives, one of the coolest thing they did was they digitized all those articles and put them up. This stuff is awesome. Seriously. And again, it's what I love about listening to the audio that you know we listen to, and that is it's as it happened. This is what they did. This is what they said. This is how it was. And so, for whatever reason, I find that extremely interesting and cool. All right. So, if you're just joining us, this program repeats itself right now. And what you'll hear is you'll hear some news headlines, and then there's a report filed on Iwo Jima on D+3, a reporter there with his recording stuff in 1945, and you'll hear airstrikes and his kind of narrating as they do that, and then you'll hear a guy who won the medal, a recipient of the Medal of Honor, a corporal, Woody Williams. Was part of the coin toss at the Super Bowl that was most recently conducted. And Woody was a corporal in the 28th Marine Regiment, and for actions on the 23rd of February, same day the flag went up. The flags went up. He knocked out 7 pillboxes with his flamethrower. Interestingly enough, he says he doesn't remember much of it. And he talks about going in to see the Commandant. So you hear that about 7-minute interview. Yeah, the Medal of Honor Society does great interviews with their recipients. So if you're ever looking for stuff, if you find something done by the, I think it's the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, they produce great stuff. Very well done. So, on a Tuesday, have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and out.